thing. In fact, the thieves might have stolen it for resale without realizing that it wasn't just detergent. It could have been worse. The kitchen money was only about $1,000 for minor emergencies. The thieves did not find the rest of our money. Some of it hidden out by our lemon tree, and some hidden with our two remaining guns under the floor in Corey's closet. Dad had gone to a lot of trouble to make a kind of floor safe, not locked, but completely concealed beneath a rug and a battered chest of drawers filled with sewing things, salvaged bits of cloth, buttons, zippers, hooks, things like that. The chest of drawers could be moved with one hand. It slid from one side of the closet to the other if you pushed it right, and in seconds you could have the money and the guns in your hands. The concealment trick wouldn't have defeated people who had time to make a thorough search, but it had defeated our thieves. They had dumped some of the drawers onto the floor, but they had not thought to look under the chest. The thieves did take Corey's sewing machine. It was a compact, sturdy old machine with its own carrying case. Both case and machine were gone. That was a real blow. Corey and I both used the machine to make, alter, and repair clothing for the family. I had thought I might even be able to earn some money with the machine, sewing for other people in the neighborhood. Now the machine is gone. Sewing for the family will have to be done by hand. It will take much more time, and may not look like what we're used to. Bad. Hard. But not a fatal blow. Corey cried over the loss of her machine, but we can get along without it. She's just being worn down by one blow after another. We'll adapt. We'll have to. God is change. Strange how much it helps me to remember that. Curtis Talcott just came to my window to tell me that the firemen have found charred bodies and bones in the ashes of the Payne Parish House. The police are here, taking reports of the robberies and the obvious arson. I told Corey. She can tell Wardell Parish or let the cops tell him. He's lying down on one of our living room couches. I doubt that he's sleeping. Even though I've never liked him, I feel sorry for him. He's lost his home and his family. He's the only survivor. What must that be like? Tuesday, December 29th, 2026. I don't know how long it can last, but in some way that I suspect is not quite legal, Corey has taken over part of the job Dad held for so long. She'll give the classes Dad gave. With the computer hookups we have already in place, she'll issue assignments, receive homework, and be available for phone and CompuConferences. The administrative part of Dad's work will be handled by someone else who can use the extra money and who is willing to show up at the college more often than once or twice a month. It will be as though Dad were still teaching but had decided to give up his other responsibilities. Corey has arranged this by pleading and begging, by crying and cajoling, and calling in every favor and every friend she could think of. People at the college know her. She taught there before Bennett's birth, before she saw the need here, and began the front room school that serves all the children of the neighborhood. Dad was all for her quitting the college because he didn't want her going back and forth outside, exposed to all the dangers that involved. The neighbors pay a per-kid fee, but it isn't much. No one could support a household on it. Now Corey will have to go outside again. She's already drafting men and older boys in the neighborhood to escort her when she has to go out. There are plenty of unemployed men here, and Corey will be paying them a small fee. So in a few days, the new term will start, and Corey will do Dad's work. While I do her work, I'll handle the school with help from her and from Russell Dory, Joanne and Harry's grandfather. He used to be a high school math teacher. He's been retired for years, but he's still sharp. I don't think I need his help, but Corey does. And he's willing, so that's that. Alex Montoya and Kayla Talcott will take over Dad's preaching and other church work. Neither is ordained, but both have substituted for Dad in the past. Both have authority in the community and the church, and of course, both know their Bible. This is how we will survive and hold together. It will work. I don't know how long it will last, but for now, it will work. Wednesday, December 30th, 2026. Wardell Parrish has finally dragged himself back to his people, to the part of his family that he lived with before he and his sister inherited the Sims' house. He stayed with us since his sister and all her children were killed. Corey gave him some of Dad's clothes, which were too big for him, much too big. He wandered around, not talking, not seeming to see anything, not eating enough. Then yesterday, he said, like a little boy, I want to go home. I can't stay here. I hate it here. Everyone's dead. I have to go home. So today, Wyatt Talcott, Michael, and Curtis escorted him home. Poor man. He's years older than he was a week ago. I think he may not live much longer. 2027. We are Earth Seed. We are flesh. Self-aware, questing, problem-solving flesh. We are that aspect of earth life best able to shape God knowingly. We are earth life maturing, earth life preparing to fall away from the parent world. We are earth life preparing to take root in new ground. Earth life fulfilling its purpose, its promise, its destiny. Chapter 14. In order to rise from its own ashes, the phoenix first must burn. Earthseed, the Books of the Living. Saturday, July 31st, 2027, morning. Last night when I escaped from the neighborhood, it was burning. The houses, the trees, the people, burning. Smoke awoke me, and I shouted down the hall to Corey and the boys. I grabbed my clothes and emergency pack and followed Corey as she herded the boys out. The bell never rang. Our watchers must have been killed before they could reach it. Everything was chaos. People running, screaming, shooting. The gate had been destroyed. Our attackers had driven an ancient truck through it. They must have stolen a truck just to crash it through our gate. I think they must have been pyro addicts, bald people with painted heads, faces and hands, red faces, blue faces, green faces, screaming mouths, avid, crazy eyes glittering in the firelight. They shot us and shot us and shot us. I saw Natalie Moss running, screaming, then pitching backward, her face half gone, her body still impelled forward. She fell flat on her back and did not move again. I fell with her, caught up in her death. I lay there, dazed, struggling to move, to get up. Corey and the boys, running ahead of me, never noticed. They ran on. I got up, felt for my pack, found it, and ran. I tried not to see what was happening around me. Hearing the gunfire and the screams didn't stop me. A dead body, Edwin Dunn, didn't stop me. I bent down, snatched up his gun, and kept running. Someone screamed near me, then tackled me, pulled me down. I fired the gun in reflexive terror and took the terrible impact in my own stomach. The green face hung above mine, mouth open, eyes wide, not yet feeling all his pain. I shot him again, terrified that his pain would immobilize me when he did feel it. It seemed that he took a long time to die. When I could move again, I pushed his body off me. I got up, still holding the gun, and ran for the wrecked gate. Best to be in the darkness outside, best to hide. I ran up Meredith Street, away from Durant Road, away from the fires and the shooting. I had lost track of Corey and the boys. I thought they would go toward the hills and not toward the center of town. Every direction was dangerous. But there was more danger where there were more people. In the night, a woman and three kids might look like a gift basket of food, money, and sex. North toward the hills, north through the dark streets to where the nearby hills and mountains blotted out the stars. And then what? I didn't know. I couldn't think. I'd never been outside the walls when it was so dark. My only hope of staying alive was to listen, hear any movement before it got too close to me, to see what I could by starlight, be as quiet as I could. I walked down the middle of the street, looking and listening and trying to avoid potholes and chunks of broken asphalt. There was little other trash. Anything that would burn, people would use as fuel. Anything that could be reused or sold had been gathered. Corey used to comment on that. Poverty, she said, had made the streets cleaner. Where was she? Where had she taken my brothers? Were they all right? Had they even gotten out of the neighborhood? I stopped. Were my brothers back there? Was Curtis? I hadn't seen him at all. Though if anyone were going to survive this insanity, it would be the Talcotts. But we had no way of finding each other. Sound. Footsteps. Two pairs of running footsteps. I stayed where I was, frozen in place. No sudden moves to draw attention to me. Had I already been seen? Could I be seen? A figure of darker darkness in an otherwise empty street? The sound was behind me. I listened and knew that it was off to one side, approaching, passing. Two people running down a side street, indifferent to the noise they made, indifferent to woman-shaped shadows. I let out a breath and drew another through my mouth because I could get more air with less sound that way. I couldn't go back to the fires and the pain. If Corey and the boys were there, they were dead, or worse, captive. But they had been ahead of me. They must have gotten out. Corey wouldn't let them come back to look for me. There was a bright glow in the air over what had been our neighborhood. If she had gotten the boys away, all she had to do was look back to know that she didn't want to go back. Did she have her Smith & Wesson? I wished I had it, and the two boxes of ammunition that went with it. All I had was a knife in my pack, and Edwin Dunn's old 45 automatic, and all the ammunition I had for it was in it, if it wasn't empty. I knew the gun. It held 7 rounds. I'd fired it twice. How many times had Edwin Dunn fired it before someone shot him? I didn't expect to find out until morning. I had a flashlight in my pack, but I didn't intend to use it unless I could be certain I wouldn't be making a target of myself. During the day, the sight of the bulge in my pocket would be enough to make people think twice about robbing or raping me, but during the night, the blue gun would be all but invisible even in my hand. If it were empty, I could only use it as a club. And the moment I hit someone with it, I might as well hit myself. If I lost consciousness for any reason during a fight, I would lose all my possessions, if not my life. Tonight, I had to hide. Tomorrow, I would have to try to bluff as much as possible. Most people wouldn't insist on my shooting them just to test whether or not the gun was loaded. For the street poor, unable to afford medical care, even a minor wound might be fatal. I am one of the street poor now. Not as poor as some, but homeless, alone, full of books, and ignorant of reality. Unless I meet someone from the neighborhood, there's no one I can afford to trust, no one to back me up. 3 miles to the hills. I kept to the starlit back streets, listening and looking around. The gun was in my hand. I meant to keep it there. I could hear dogs barking and snarling, fighting somewhere not far off. I was in a cold sweat. I had never been more terrified in my life. Yet, nothing attacked me. Nothing found me. I didn't go all the way to the hills. Instead, I found a burnt-out, unwalled house a few blocks before the end of Meredith Street. Fear of dogs had made me keep an eye open for anything that might provide shelter. The house was a ruin, a plundered ruin. It wasn't safe to walk into with or without light. It was a roofless collection of upright black bones. But it had been built up off the ground. 5 concrete steps led up to what had been the front porch. There should be a way under the house. What if other people were under it? I walked around it, listening, trying to see. Then, instead of daring to crawl under, I settled in what was left of the attached garage. A corner of it was still standing, and there was enough rubble in front of that corner to conceal me if I didn't show a light. Also, if I were surprised, I could get out of the garage faster than I could crawl out from under a house. The concrete floor could not collapse under me as the wooden floor might in what was left of the house proper. It was as good as I was going to get, and I was exhausted. I didn't know whether I could sleep, but I had to rest. Morning now. What shall I do? I did sleep a little, but I kept startling awake. Every sound woke me. The wind, rats, insects, then squirrels and birds. I don't feel rested, but I'm a little less exhausted. So, what shall I do? How is it that we had never established an outside meeting place, somewhere where the family could reunite after disaster? I remember suggesting to Dad that we do that, but he had never done anything about it, and I hadn't pushed the idea as I should have. Poor God-shaping, lack of forethought. What now? Now I have to go home. I don't want to. The idea scares me to death. It's taken me a long time just to write the word, home. But I have to know about my brothers, and about Corey and Curtis. I don't know how I can help if they're hurt or being held by someone. I don't know what might be waiting for me back at the neighborhood. More painted faces, the police. I'm in trouble either way. If the police are there, I'll have to hide my gun before I go in. My gun. And my small amount of money. Carrying a gun can win you a lot of unwanted attention from the police if you catch them in the wrong mood. Yet, everyone who has one carries it. The trick, of course, is not to get caught carrying it. On the other hand, if the painted faces are still there, I can't go in at all. How long do those people stay high on pyro and fire? Do they hang around after their fun to steal whatever's left and maybe kill a few more people? No matter. I have to go and see. I have to go home. Saturday, July 31st, 2027, evening. I have to write. I don't know what else to do. The others are asleep now, but it isn't dark. I'm on watch because I couldn't sleep. If I tried, I'm jittery and crazed. I can't cry. I want to get up and just run and run. Run away from everything. But there isn't any away. I have to write. There's nothing familiar left to me but the writing. God is change. I hate God. I have to write. There were no unburned houses back in the neighborhood, although some were burned worse than others. I don't know whether police or firefighters ever came. If they had come, they were gone when I got there. The neighborhood was wide open and crawling with scavengers. I stood at the gate, staring in as strangers picked among the black bones of our homes. The ruins were still smoking, but men, women, and children were all over them, digging through them, picking fruit from the trees, stripping our dead, quarreling or fighting over new acquisitions, stashing things away in clothing or bundles. Who were these people? I put my hand on the gun in my pocket. It had 4 rounds left in it, and I went in. I was grimy from lying in dirt and ashes all night. I might not be noticed. I saw 3 women from an unwalled part of Durant Road digging through what was left of the Yanis house. They were laughing and throwing around chunks of wood and plaster. Where were Shani Yanis and her daughters? Where were her sisters? I walked through the neighborhood, looking past the human maggots, trying to find some of the people I had grown up with. I found dead ones. Edwin Dunn lay where he had when I took his gun, but now he was shirtless and shoeless. His pockets had been turned out. The ground was littered with ash-covered corpses, some burned or half blown apart by automatic weapons fire. Dried or nearly dried blood had pooled in the street. 2 men were prying loose our emergency bell. The bright, clear, early morning sunlight made the whole scene less real somehow, more nightmare-like. I stood in front of our house and stared at the 5 adults and the child who were picking through the ruins of it. Who were these vultures? Did the fire draw them? Is that what the street poor do, run to fire and hope to find a corpse to strip? There was a dead green face on our front porch. I went up the steps and stood looking at him, at her. The green face was a woman, tall, lean, bald, but female. And what had she died for? What was the point of all this? Leave her alone. A woman who had a pair of Corey's shoes in her hand strode up to me. She died for all of us. Leave her alone. I've never in my life wanted more to kill another human being. Get the hell out of my way, I said. I didn't raise my voice. I don't know how I looked, but the thief backed away. I stepped over the green face and went into the carcass of our home. The other thieves looked at me, but none of them said anything. One pair, I noticed, was a man with a small boy. The man was dressing the boy in a pair of my brother Gregory's jeans. The jeans were much too big, but the man belted them and rolled them up. And where was Gregory? My clownish smart ass of a baby brother. Where was he? Where was everyone? The roof of our house had fallen in. Most things had burned. Kitchen, living room, dining room, my room. The floor wasn't safe to walk on. I saw one of the scavengers fall through, give a surprised yell, then climb, unhurt, onto a floor joist. Nothing left in my room could be salvaged. Ashes. A heat-distorted metal bed frame. The broken metal and ceramic remains of my lamp, bunches of ashes that had been clothing or books. Many books were not burned through. They were useless, but they had been packed so tightly together that the fire had burned in deeply from the edges and the spines. Rough circles of unburnt paper remained, surrounded by ash. I didn't find a single whole page. The back 2 bedrooms had survived better. That was where the scavengers were and where I headed. I found bundled pairs of my father's socks, folded shorts and T-shirts, and an extra holster that I could use for the .45. All this I found in or under the unpromising-looking remains of Dad's chest of drawers. Most things were burned beyond use, but I stuffed the best of what I found into my pack. The man with the child came over to scavenge beside me. And somehow, perhaps because of the child, because this stranger in his filthy rags was someone's father too, I didn't mind. The little boy watched the two of us, his small brown face expressionless. He did look a little like Gregory. I dug a dried apricot out of my pack and held it out to him. He couldn't have been more than 6, but he wouldn't touch the food until the man told him to. Good discipline. But at the man's nod, he snatched the apricot, bit off a tiny taste, then stuffed the rest into his mouth whole. So, in the company of 5 strangers, I plundered my family's home. The ammunition under the closet floor in my parents' room had burned, had no doubt exploded. The closet was badly charred. So much for the money hidden there. I took dental floss, soap, and a jar of petroleum jelly from my parents' bathroom. Everything else was already gone. I managed to gather 1 set of outer clothing each for Corey and my brothers. In particular, I found shoes for them. There was a woman scavenging among Marcus's shoes, and she glared at me, but she kept quiet. My brothers had run out of the house in their pajamas. Corey had thrown on a coat. I had been the last to get out of the house because I had risked stopping to grab jeans, a sweatshirt, and shoes as well as my emergency pack. I could have been killed. If I had thought about what I was doing, if I had had to think, no doubt, I would have been killed. I reacted the way I'd trained myself to react. Though my training was far from up to date, more memory than anything else, I hadn't practiced late at night for ages, yet my self-administered training had worked. Now, if I could get these clothes to Corey and my brothers, I might be able to make up for their lack of training, especially if I could get the money under the rocks by the lemon tree. I put clothes and shoes into a salvaged pillowcase, looked around for blankets and couldn't find one. They must have been grabbed early. All the more reason to get the lemon tree money. I went out to the peach tree, and being tall, managed to reach a couple of nearly ripe peaches that other scavengers had missed. Then I looked around, as though for something more to take, and surprised myself by almost crying at the sight of Corey's big, well-tended back garden, trampled into the ground. Peppers, tomatoes, squashes, carrots, cucumbers, lettuce, melons, sunflowers, beans, corn. Much of it wasn't ripe yet, but what hadn't been stolen had been destroyed. I scavenged a few carrots, a couple of handfuls of sunflower seeds from flower heads that lay on the ground, and a few bean pods from vines Corey had planted to run up the sunflower stalks and corn plants. I took what was left, the way I thought a late-arriving scavenger would, and I worked my way toward the lemon tree. When I reached it, heavy with little green lemons, I hunted for any with even a hint of paling, of yellow. I took a few from the tree and from the ground. Corey had planted shade-loving flowers at the base of the tree, and they had thrived there. She and my father had scattered small, rounded boulders among these in a way that seemed no more than decorative. A few of these had been turned over, crushing the flowers near them. In fact, the rock with the money under it had been turned over. But the 2 or 3 inches of dirt over the money packet, triple-wrapped and heat-sealed in plastic, was undisturbed. I snatched the packet in no more time than it had taken to pick up a couple of lemons a moment before. First, I spotted the hiding place, then I snatched up the money packet along with a handful of dirt, then eager to leave, but terrified of drawing attention to myself, I picked up a few more lemons and hunted around for more food. The figs were hard and green instead of purple, and the persimmons were yellow-green instead of orange. I found a single ear of corn left on a downed stalk and used it to stuff the money packet deeper into my blanket pack. Then I left, with my pack on my back and the pillowcase in my left arm, resting on my hip like a baby. I walked down the driveway to the street. I kept my right hand free for the gun still in my pocket. I had not taken time to put on the holster. There were more people within the walls than there had been when I arrived. I had to walk past most of them to get out. Others were leaving with their loads, and I tried to follow them without quite attaching myself to any particular group. This meant that I moved more slowly than I would have chosen to. I had time to look at the corpses and see what I didn't want to see. Richard Moss, stark naked, lying in a pool of his own blood, his house, closer to the gate than ours, had been burned to the ground. Only the chimney stuck up, blackened and naked from the rubble. Where were his two surviving wives, Karen and Zara? Or had they survived? Where were all his many children? Little Robin Balter, naked, filthy, bloody between her legs, cold, bony, barely pubescent. Yet, she might have married my brother Marcus someday. She might have been my sister. She had always been such a bright, sharp, great little kid, all serious and knowing, 12, going on 35, Cora used to say. She always smiled when she said it. Russell Dory, Robin's grandfather, only his shoes had been taken. His body had been almost torn apart by automatic weapons fire. An old man and a child. What had the painted faces gotten for all their killing? "She died for us," the scavenger woman had said of the green face. Some kind of insane burn the rich movement, Keith had said. We've never been rich, but to the desperate we looked rich. We were surviving, and we had our wall. Did our community die so that addicts could make a help-the-poor political statement? There were other corpses. I didn't get a close look at most of them. They littered the front yards, the street, and the island. There was no sign of our emergency bell now. The men who had wanted it had carried it away, perhaps to be sold for its metal. I saw Layla Yanis, Shani's oldest daughter. Like Robin, she had been raped. I saw Michael Talcott, one side of his head smashed in. I didn't look around for Curtis. I was terrified that I might see him lying nearby. I was almost out of control as it was, and I couldn't draw attention to myself. I couldn't be anything more than another scavenger hauling away treasure. Bodies passed under my eyes. Jeremy Balter, one of Robin's brothers. Philip Moss, George Sue, his wife, and his oldest son, Juana Montoya, Ruben Quintanilla, Lydia Cruz. Lydia was only 8 years old. She had been raped, too. I made it back through the gate. I didn't break down. I hadn't seen Corey or my brothers in the carnage. That didn't mean they weren't there, but I hadn't seen them. They might be alive. Curtis might be alive. Where could I look for them? The Talcotts had relatives living in Robledo, but I didn't know where. Somewhere on the other side of River Street. I couldn't look for them, though Curtis might have gone to them. Why hadn't anyone else stayed to salvage what they could? I circled the neighborhood, keeping the wall in sight, then made a greater circle. I saw no one, or at least no one I knew. I saw other street poor who stared at me. Then, because I didn't know what else to do, I headed back toward my burned-out garage on Meredith Street. I couldn't call the police. All the phones I knew of were slag. No strangers would let you use their phone if they had phones. And I didn't know anyone whom I could pay to call and trust to make the call. Most people would avoid me or be tempted to keep my money and never call. And anyway, if the police have ignored what's been done to my neighborhood so far, if such a fire and so many corpses can be ignored, why should I go to them? What would they do? Arrest me? Take my cash as their fee? I wouldn't be surprised. Best to stay clear of them. But where is my family? Someone called my name. I turned around, my hand in my pocket, and saw Zara Moss and Harry Balter. Richard Moss's youngest wife and Robin Balter's oldest brother. They were an unlikely pair, but they were definitely together. They managed without touching each other to give the appearance of all but clinging together. Both were blood-spattered and ragged. I looked at Harry's battered, swollen face and remembered that Joanne had loved him, or thought she had, and that he wouldn't marry her and go with her to Olivar because he believed what Dad believed about Olivar. "Are you all right?" he asked me. I nodded, remembering Robin. Did he know? Russell, Dory, Robin, and Jeremy. "They beat you up?" I asked, feeling stupid and awkward. I didn't want to tell him his grandfather, brother, and sister were dead. "I had to fight my way out last night. I was lucky they didn't shoot me." He swayed, looked around. "Let's sit on the curb." Both Zara and I looked around, made sure no one else was nearby. We sat with Harry between us. I sat on my pillowcase of clothing. Zara and Harry were fully dressed in spite of their coating of blood and dirt, but they carried nothing. Did they have nothing? Or had they left their things somewhere, perhaps with whatever was left of their families? And where was Zara's little girl, Bibi? Did she know that Richard Moss was dead? "Everyone's dead," Zara whispered, as though speaking into my thoughts. "Everyone. Those painted bastards killed them all." "No." Harry shook his head. "We got out. There'll be some others." He sat with his face in his hands, and I wondered whether he was more hurt than I had thought. I wasn't sharing any serious pain with him. "Have either of you seen my brothers or Corey?" I asked. "Dead," Zara whispered. "Like my Bibi, all dead." I jumped. "No, not all of them, no. Did you see them?" "I saw most of the Montoya family," Harry said. He wasn't talking to me as much as musing aloud. "We saw them last night. They said Juana was dead. The rest of them were going to walk to Glendale, where their relatives live." "But," I began, "and I saw Letitia Sue. She had been stabbed 40 or 50 times. But did you see my brothers?" I had to ask. "They're all dead, I told you," Zara said. "They got out, but the paints caught them and dragged them back and killed them, I saw. One of them had me down, and he... I saw..." "She was being raped when she saw my family dragged back and killed? Was that what she meant? Was it true?" "I went back this morning," I said. "I didn't see their bodies, didn't see any of them." "Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no. I saw. Your mother, all of them, I saw." Zara hugged herself. "I didn't want to see, but I saw." We all sat without talking. I don't know how long we sat there. Now and then someone walked past us and looked at us, some dirty, ragged person with bundles. Cleaner people in little bunches rode past us on bikes. A group of three rode past on motorcycles, their electric hum and whine strange in the quiet street. When I got up, the other two looked at me. For no reason except habit, I picked up my pillowcase. I don't know what I meant to do with the things in it. It had occurred to me, though, that I should get back to my garage before someone else settled there. I wasn't thinking very well. It was as though that garage was home now, and all I wanted in the world was to be there. Harry got up and almost fell down again. He bent and threw up into the gutter. The side of his throwing up grabbed at me, and I only just managed to look away in time to avoid joining him. He finished, spat, turned to face Zara and me, and coughed. I feel like hell, he said. They hit him in the head last night, Zara explained. He got me away from the guy who was... Well, you know, he got me away. But they hurt him. There's a burnt-out garage where I slept last night, I said. It's a long walk. But he can rest there. We can all rest there. Zara took my pillowcase and carried it. Maybe something in it could do her some good. We walked on either side of Harry and kept him from stopping or wandering off or staggering too much. Somehow, we got him to the garage. Chapter 15. Kindness eases change. Earthseed, the Books of the Living. Sunday, August 1st, 2027. Harry slept most of the day today. Zara and I took turns staying with him. He has a concussion, at least, and he needs time to heal. We haven't talked about what we'll do if he gets sicker instead of healing. Zara doesn't want to abandon him because he fought to save her. I don't want to abandon him because I've known him all my life. He's a good guy. I wonder if there's some way to get in touch with the Garfields. They would give him a home, or at least see that he has medical care. But he doesn't seem to be getting worse. He totters out to the fenced backyard to urinate. He eats the food and drinks the water that I give him. With no need for discussion, we're eating and drinking sparingly from my supplies. They're all we have. Soon, we'll have to risk going out to buy more. But today, Sunday, is a day of rest and healing for us. The pain of Harry's headache and his bruised, beaten body are almost welcome to me. They're distractions. Along with Zara's talking and crying for her dead daughter, they fill my mind. Their misery eases my own somehow. It gives me moments when I don't think about my family. Everyone is dead. But how can they be? Everyone? Zara has a soft little girl voice that I used to think was phony. It's real. But it takes on a sandpaper roughness when she's upset. It sounds painful, as though it's abrading her throat as she speaks. She had seen her daughter killed, seen the blue face who shot Bibi as Zara ran carrying her. She believed the blue face was enjoying himself, shooting at all the moving targets. She said his expression reminded her of a man having sex. I fell down, she whispered. I thought I was dead. I thought he had killed me. There was blood, then I saw Bibi's head drop to one side. A red face grabbed her from me. I didn't see where he came from. He grabbed her and threw her into the Sioux house. The house was burning everywhere. He threw her into the fire. I went crazy then. I don't know what I did. Somebody grabbed me. Then I was free. Then somebody shoved me down and fell on me. I couldn't get my breath, and he tore my clothes. Then he was on me, and I couldn't do nothing. That's when I saw your mother, your brothers. Then Harry was there, and he pulled the bastard off me. He told me later that I was screaming. I don't know what I was doing. He was beating up the guy he'd pulled off of me when a new guy jumped him. I hit the new guy with a rock, and Harry knocked the other one out. Then we got away. We just ran. We didn't sleep. We hid between two unwalled houses down the street away from the fire until a guy came out with an axe and chased us away. Then we just wandered until we found you. We didn't even really know each other before. You know, Richard never wanted us to have much to do with the neighbors, especially the white ones. I nodded, remembering Richard Moss. He's dead, you know, I said. I saw him. I wanted to take the words back as soon as I'd said them. I didn't know how to tell someone her husband was dead, but there must be a better, gentler way than that. She stared at me, stricken. I wanted to apologize for my bluntness, but I didn't think it would help. I'm sorry, I said in a kind of generic apology for everything. She began to cry, and I repeated, I'm sorry. I held her and let her cry. Harry woke up, drank a little water, and listened while Zara told how Richard Moss had bought her from her homeless mother when she was only 15, younger than I had thought, and brought her to live in the first house she had ever known. He gave her enough to eat and didn't beat her, and even when her co-wives were hateful to her, it was 1,000 times better than living outside with her mother and starving. Now she was outside again. In 6 years, she had gone from nothing to nothing. Do you have some place to go? She asked us at last. Do you know anybody who still has a house? I looked at Harry. You might be able to get into Olivar if you can walk there from here. The Garfields would take you in. He thought about that for a while. I don't want to, he said. I don't think there's any more future in Olivar than there was in our neighborhood. But at least in our neighborhood, we had the guns. For all the good it did us, Zara muttered. I know. But they were our guns, not hired gunmen. No one could turn them against us. In Olivar, from what Joanne said, no one's allowed to have a gun, except the security force, and who the hell are they? Company people, I said, people from outside Olivar. He nodded. That's what I heard, too. Maybe it will be all right, but it doesn't sound all right. It sounds better than starving, Zara said. You guys have never missed a meal, have you? I'm going north, I said. I planned to go anyway once my family was back on its feet. Now I have no family, and I'm going. North where? Zara demanded. Up toward Canada. The way things are now, I may not be able to get that far. But I'll get to a place where water doesn't cost more than food, and where work brings a salary. Even a small one. I'm not going to spend my life as some kind of 21st century slave. North is where I'm headed, too, Harry said. There's nothing here. I've tried for over a year to get a job here. Any job that pays money. There's nothing. I want to work for money and get some college. The only jobs that pay serious money are the kind our parents had, the kind that require college degrees. I looked at him, wanting to ask something, hesitating, plunging. Harry, what about your parents? I don't know, he said. I didn't see them killed. Zara says she didn't. I don't know where anyone is. We got separated. I swallowed. I didn't see your parents, I said, but I did see some of your other relatives. Dead. Who? He demanded. I guess there really isn't any way to tell people that their close relatives are dead except to say it, no matter how much you don't want to. Your grandfather, I said. And Jeremy and Robin. Robin and Jeremy? Kids? Little kids? Zara took his hand. They kill little kids, she said. Out here in the world, they kill kids every day. He didn't cry. Or maybe he cried when we were asleep. First, though, he closed himself up. Stopped talking, stopped responding, stopped doing anything until it was nearly dark. By then, Zara had gone out and come back with my brother Bennett's shirt full of ripe peaches. Don't ask me where I got them, she said. I assume you stole them, I said. Not from anyone around here, I hope. No sense making the neighbors mad. She lifted an eyebrow. I don't need you to tell me how to live out here. I was born out here. Eat your peaches. I ate four of them. They were delicious, and too ripe to travel well anyway. Why don't you try on some of those clothes, I said. Take what fits you. She fit not only into Marcus's shirt and jeans, though she had to roll the jean legs up, but into his shoes. Shoes are expensive. Now she has two pair. You let me do it. I'll trade these little shoes for some food, she said. I nodded. Tomorrow. Whatever you get, we'll split it. Then I'm leaving. Going north? Yes. Just north? Do you know anything about the roads and towns and where to buy stuff or steal it? Have you got money? I have maps, I said. They're old. But I think they're still good. No one's been building new roads lately. Hell no. Money? A little? Not enough, I suspect. No such thing as enough money. What about him? She gestured toward Harry's unmoving back. He was lying down. I couldn't tell whether he was asleep or not. He has to decide for himself, I said. Maybe he wants to hang around to look for his family before he goes. He turned over slowly. He looked sick, but fully aware. Zara put the peaches she had saved for him next to him. I don't want to wait for anything, he said. I wish we could start now. I hate this place. You going with her? Zara asked, jabbing a thumb at me. He looked at me. We might be able to help each other, he said. At least we know each other, and I managed to grab a few $100 as I ran out of the house. He was offering trust. He meant we could trust each other. That was no small thing. I was thinking of traveling as a man, I said to him. He seemed to be repressing a smile. That will be safer for you. You're at least tall enough to fool people. You'll have to cut your hair, though. Zara grunted. Mixed couples catch hell, whether people think they're gay or straight. Harry'll piss off all the blacks, and you'll piss off all the whites. Good luck. I watched her as she said it, and realized what she wasn't saying. You want to come? I asked. She sniffed. Why should I? I won't cut my hair. No need, I said. We can be a black couple and their white friend. If Harry can get a reasonable tan, maybe we can claim him as a cousin. She hesitated, then whispered, Yeah, I want to go. And she started to cry. Harry stared at her in surprise. Did you think we were going to just dump you? I asked. All you had to do was let us know. I don't have any money, she said. Not a dollar. I sighed. Where did you get those peaches? You were right, I stole them. You have a useful skill, then. And information about living out here. I faced Harry. What do you think? Her stealing doesn't bother you, he asked. I mean to survive, I said. Thou shalt not steal, he quoted. Years and years, a lifetime of thou shalt not steal. I had to smother a flash of anger before I could answer. He wasn't my father. He had no business quoting scripture at me. He was nobody. I didn't look at him. I didn't speak until I knew my voice would sound normal. Then, I said, I mean to survive, I told him. Don't you? He nodded. It wasn't a criticism. I'm just surprised. I hope it won't ever mean getting caught or leaving someone else to starve, I said, and to my own surprise, I smiled. I've thought about it. That's the way I feel, but I've never stolen anything.
You're kidding,
Zara said. I shrugged. It's true. I grew up trying to set a good example for my brothers and trying to live up to my father's expectations. That seemed like what I should be doing.
Oldest kid, Harry said. I know.
He was the oldest in his family.
Oldest hell, Zara said, laughing. You're both babies out here.
And that wasn't offensive somehow. Perhaps because it was true. I'm inexperienced, I admitted, but I can learn. You're going to be one of my teachers.
One? She said. Who have you got but me?
Everyone. She looked scornful. No one. Everyone who's surviving out here knows things that I need to know, I said. I'll watch them. I'll listen to them. I'll learn from them. If I don't, I'll be killed. And like I said, I intend to survive.
They'll sell you a bowl of shit, she said.
I nodded. I know. But I'll buy as few of those as possible. She looked at me for a long time, then sighed.
I wish I'd known you better before all this happened, she said. You're a weird preacher's kid. If you still want to play man, I'll cut your hair for you.
Monday, August 2nd, 2027. From notes expanded Sunday, August 8th. We're on our way. This morning, Zara took us to Hanning Joss, the biggest secure store complex in Robledo. We could get all we needed there. Hanning vendors sell everything, from gourmet food to delousing cream, prosthesis to home birthing kits, guns to the latest in touch rings, headsets, and recordings. I could have spent days just wandering through the aisles, staring at the stuff I couldn't afford. I had never been to Hanning before, had never seen anything like it in person. But we had to go into the complex one at a time, leaving two outside to guard our bundles, including my gun. Hanning, as I had heard many times on the radio, was one of the safest places in the city. If you didn't like their sniffers, metal detectors, package restrictions, armed guards, and willingness to strip search anyone they thought was suspicious on the way in or out, you could shop somewhere else. The store was full of people eager to put up with the inconvenience and invasion of privacy if only they could buy the things they needed in peace. No one strip-searched me, though I was required to prove that I wasn't a deadbeat.
Show your Hanning disc or money, an armed guard demanded at the massive gates.
I was terrified that he would steal my money, but I showed the bills that I intended to spend, and he nodded. He never touched them. No doubt we were both being watched, and our behaviors recorded. Such a security-conscious store wouldn't want its guard stealing the customer's money.
Shop in peace, the guard said with no hint of a smile.
I bought salt, a small tube of honey, and the cheapest of dried foods. Oats, fruit, nuts, bean flour, lentils, plus a little dried beef. All that I thought Zara and I could carry. And I bought more water and a few odd items. Water purification tablets, just in case, and sun blocker, which even Zara and I would need. Some stuff for insect bites and an ointment Dad used for muscle aches. We would have plenty of those. I bought more toilet paper, tampons, and lip balm. I bought myself a new notebook, two more pens, and an expensive supply of ammunition for the .45. I felt better once I had that. I bought three of the cheap multi-purpose sleep sacks, big, tough storage bags, and the preferred bedding of all the more affluent homeless. The country was full of people who could earn or steal food and water, but couldn't rent even